This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. 500 years ago, the Duke of Milan received a long letter from a man applying for a job as a military engineer. At the end, he tacked on a postscript. In peace, he wrote, I believe I can give you as complete satisfaction as anyone on the construction of buildings, both public and private. I can further execute sculpture in marble, bronze, or clay, and in painting, I can do as much as anyone, whoever he may be. Well, like they say, it ain't bragging if you can do it. And Leonardo da Vinci could do all that and more. Scientist, inventor, theorist, teacher, and an artist who changed the way we see the world. Not, however, a master of the deadline. Leonardo was notorious for jilting his patrons and abandoning projects in midstream. He is universally acknowledged as a great painter, the Mona Lisa, the Last Supper, two of the most famous images in the world, but there are only 13 other of his paintings. There are, though, thousands of doodles, drawings, and sketches. A new exhibit of his drawings opens next week at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York. It's called Leonardo da Vinci, Master Draftsman, and contains about 120 rarely seen drawings and 30 works by Leonardo's teacher and his pupils. It will be the largest exhibition of Leonardo's work ever presented in the U.S., one of the biggest of all time, and it promises to give us fresh insight into the creative process of a genius. So, what do you know about Leonardo da Vinci? Or, perhaps more important, what don't you know about him? And why does an artist who's been dead for 500 years continue to attract crowds and controversy? Our phone number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. And joining us now is Carmen Bombach, curator of drawings and prints at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York. She's responsible for the exhibition Leonardo da Vinci, and she now joins us by phone from the Met in New York. Thanks for joining us. It must be a very hectic time for you.
It's a wonderful, exciting moment. It's probably a once-in-a-lifetime moment for us, opening the crates and seeing the masterpiece after masterpiece come out of the crates, installing them, seeing so many of the works together, in company, things that have never been seen together before, others that have not been exhibited in the same way since 1939, say at the Great Milan Exhibition. It's really a transforming moment for us. Thank you.
I know that some of these drawings are owned by the Met, but many others you had to go beg or borrow from museums around the world. How did you convince them to part with their Leonardos?
We have wonderfully collaborative relationships with museums. The Met has been doing exhibitions for a very long time. We also have wonderful professional relationships at the curatorial level, and so it was really, one pounds the pavement a great deal, and asking for a Leonardo drawing is like asking for the firstborn of each aristocratic family in the 19th century. It's a process of persuasion.
Now, do you use leverage? I mean, if you go to some place, and I'm just making this up, in Rome, and say, well, the Milanese have allowed us, they're giving us three, you might as well give us four.
If we should reveal all our secrets, we should not.
Now, you, I'm sure, handled many, many, many drawings in your life. What's it like to hold a Da Vinci?
Electrifying. It's also, I think there is a sense of serenity. It's a very humbling experience, most of all. The drawings are arresting. The feeling of hanging one drawing after another in this exhibition has been sort of putting up one masterpiece after another. It's you stop and look at each one of them, and each one of them is a masterpiece of extraordinary, extraordinary power.
Yet a lot of them are, you know, we don't necessarily think of drawings or sketches in preparation for a painting, things like that, as masterpieces in their own right.
Well, there is this extraordinary sense of discovery. When you look at a drawing by Leonardo, is to really see him thinking on the paper. He is trying out ideas. he is correcting ideas, he is reinforcing ideas, he jumps from one thought to another. There's this incredible sense of immediacy. It's like, I don't know, taking a glimpse over the artist's shoulder. It's a profoundly intimate experience. To see the drawings is to understand so much about the creative process of Leonardo. If we look at, say, the Mona Lisa, The Last Supper, those are masterpieces of extraordinary expression, arresting power. But we're looking at the finished product. There's something so deeply moving to see such a creative genius at work and to be surprised by it. Every time that I look at one of his drawings that I have seen for so many times before, there's more new things to discover. It really is a process of discovery for the viewer. What's extraordinary is to look at the drawings attentively for a long period of time, and there's just each moment seems to unfold or reveal new things for us, and there is this great sense of discovery and confronting such an intimate work.
His drawings, I've read, are often displayed in what you might think of as logical groupings. I mean, he did a lot of horses, he did a lot of soldiers, he did a lot of studies of anatomy, and all of those things are presented separately. You're taking a different tack.
Yes, if we look at the drawings by Leonardo in an integrated way, we also can see what he's doing at the same time as, say, The Last Supper. One of the drawings of The Last Supper in the exhibition has the figural sketches, and it's got study of geometry. Then you turn that sheet over and you look at the other side, and then you see that there are studies for weights, for presses. We can look at yet another sheet that has a horse for the Battle of Anghiari, his most incredible unexecuted project. Was supposed to compete with Michelangelo. Then slightly lower on the sheet, you see studies for the Lira and the Swan. You go to the other side of the sheet, and you see the study of mortars shooting off a rain of stones mm-hmm. over fortifications. So you see the artistic genius at the same time, on the same sheet as a military genius. It's really an extraordinary moment. It's what communicates best the multifaceted aspects of his career.
There's also one painting in the exhibit.
Yes, it's the unfinished painting of St. Jerome from the Vatican Museums. It's a painting that has an extraordinary history. It was owned by Napoleon's uncle, and it was re-identified in the 19th century. It's an amazing painting because since Leonardo left it unfinished, we can see all the steps of his design process on the panel itself. And so it's an extraordinary glimpse into his creative process right before he started putting the paint. In one part of the painting on the upper left, there are even impressions from his fingerprints and the palms of his hand. That gives you goosebumps. We unpacked that painting yesterday, and to see it come out of the crate, it's like seeing this extraordinary masterpiece slowly emerging from the box, going to the wall. We see his fingerprints. There's something so amazingly immediate and arresting.
Was there a moment as they started to lift it out, you said, please don't drop it?
Yeah.
Have you ever been concerned by that? That they, you know, in the passage from the crate to the wall, it might fall?
We have an extraordinary team here at the Met. There must have been at least 15 people looking and also helping to hang it. It weighs about 200 pounds. But it's just such an extraordinary contribution to the exhibition, a very rare loan from the Vatican Museums.
Well, Carmen Bombach, congratulations, and thanks very much for taking time out to speak with us.
Thank you very much. It's my pleasure.
Ms. Bombach, curator of drawings and prints at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York, curator of the exhibition Leonardo da Vinci, Master Draftsman. It opens on January 22nd. It will stay open there until March the 30th, and she spoke with us by phone from the museum in New York. Well, everybody knows Leonardo could draw. You've probably seen his fanciful and futuristic sketches. You may know he's among the most famous left-handers in history. Many don't know that he was born a bastard and most likely homosexual. Joining us now to talk about Leonardo the Man is Dr. Sherwin Newland, a clinical professor of surgery at Yale School of Medicine and author of a biography of Leonardo called Leonardo da Vinci. He joins us from the studios at Yale University in New Haven, and good to have you on Talk of the Nation.
Thank you.
Logically, your fascination. Well, first of all, are you going to go down to New York and see the show?
Oh, you bet. I'll hie myself thither as soon as I can.
Now, your fascination with Leonardo, did it begin with your common interest in anatomy?
Well, yes. It's his uncommon interest in anatomy, as a matter of fact, that got me hooked in the first place. In 1977, we were visited in our Department of the History of Medicine by an Englishman named Kenneth Keel, who is one of the two leading authorities on the anatomy of Leonardo da Vinci. And Keel and I got to be very good friends. And his fascination metastasized to me. And I've been tracing Leonardo's life primarily through his anatomical work ever since that time.
Now, I've read that he came pretty close to actually discovering the human circulatory system.
Well, he might have done it. It was very difficult to say. What he did do is make some amazing insights into the way the heart itself functioned. He was the first person, for example, to realize that the heartbeat and the pulse were synchronous. This is something clearly everybody thinks is automatically understood, but it wasn't at that time. And the way he did it was simply to watch farmers who were slaughtering pigs. They would put a large tube right through the chest wall into the pig's heart to let the blood go out. And of course, there would be 20, 30 beats before all of the blood was gone, and he would watch the heartbeat. He would feel the animal's pulse at the same time, and he would synchronize the two of them plus the sound of the heart thumping against the chest wall. So he was able to identify the fact that the heart functioned like a muscle, that it leaped forward each time it beat, and that it, in fact, caused the pulse.
Now, was it his interest in anatomy that led on to his fascination with science?
Well, his fascination with science, of course, preceded all of that. It was nature that fascinated him. Anything that grew on the earth, anything that had to do with the origins of the earth, anything that represented life, movement, or emotion, he took within the area of his fascination. The real masterpiece was Leonardo himself, as a matter of fact.
We are talking about the life of Leonardo da Vinci, whom some have called the first modern mind, with Dr. Sherwin Newland, and we're going to go to a short break, and when we come back, we're going to take your calls, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, or you can send us email. Our address is TOTN@NPR.org. And by the way, here are some of the stories you can hear from NPR News later today. NPR's Kate Seeley is in Baghdad, where UN weapons inspectors say they have found empty warheads designed to carry chemical weapons. She'll have the latest on the search for banned weapons in Iraq. And back in the U.S., NPR's David Wellner is covering the clash over government spending on Capitol Hill. Republicans are arguing to cut programs and cut taxes. Democrats say vital domestic programs could suffer. You can hear those stories later today on All Things Considered, so stay tuned for that. Again, we're talking about Leonardo da Vinci, 800-989-8255. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about why 500 years later, Leonardo da Vinci still fascinates us. Our guest is Dr. Sherwin Newland, the author of a biography called Leonardo da Vinci. Did you know that Leonardo was never formally educated? You're invited to join the discussion. Our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. And why don't we hear from Jenny, who's with us in Grand Junction, Colorado.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I am on my cell phone, but I am in a parking lot.
Well, thanks very much for being safe with it.
Okay. I just recently taught a class in our school district called Art Heritage. We have a wonderful organization that does it. I did a kindergarten first and second grade class, and we were teaching about Leonardo da Vinci. Our most commonly asked question that the kids just couldn't figure out, and we didn't have a good answer for them, was exactly why did he write backwards? And the other one was, why did he, when he was towards the end of his life, feel like he really hadn't accomplished much? We had read that about him. And I can take the answer off the air.
Okay, Jenny, thanks for the call, and drive safely.
Okay, thanks.
Bye-bye.
Well, of course, there are several theories about why he wrote backwards. Many people think it was some sort of a special way of keeping his work secret. The fact is that being left-handed, it was easier for him to write backwards. Turns out that writing backwards is not difficult for lefties. As you may know, he had his own particular form of script. He wrote numbers in a particular way that was his alone. He wrote certain letters that were a particular sort of shorthand of his. I think it was simply a matter for Leonardo of inventing, as I call it, his own shorthand, as we all do. And so there was no real attempt to keep anything hidden. It was simply his way of writing as fast as he could.
Left-handedness was not necessarily looked favorably upon at the time that he lived. There were many other people who were left-handed who just switched over to the right hand.
Well, exactly. And you know that in this country that was being done as late as the 1930s and 40s. Little kids who were lefties in school were taught how to write right-handed.
Now, not only born with the, in those days at least, the disadvantage of being left-handed, if they'd invented baseball, he would have had a great advantage, but anyway, nevertheless, he had some difficulties growing up. He was not, illegitimate. He had a lot of disadvantages.
Well, perhaps not. He was much beloved by his mother, whose name was Caterina. We don't know how long he stayed with his mother. It may have been as long as 5 years. And then he was brought to the main house where his father lived and taken care of by his father's wife at that time, who loved him as much as his own natural mother did. So this was a child adored by these two women who were with him for the first 15 years of his life. And then, of course, when he got to be 15, his father saw to it that he was apprenticed to one of the master artists of Florence, Verrocchio.
Yet he was never formally educated and never did master the lingua franca of the time, Latin.
Well, that's particularly interesting because he was actually rather proud of that. He used to call himself an unlettered man. And he pointed out that the only way to really learn things was to learn them on one's own and not from the work of the ancients. He was fond of writing, for example, in his notebooks, that certainly one can drink from bottles where water has been stored, but isn't it better to drink directly from the spring, which is what he did. And he felt always that his poor Latin, very poor Latin, and even worse Greek, was a great advantage to him because it essentially forced him to do experimentations on his own, make observations on his own, make correlations on his own.
What do we know about his emotional life, if you will? What kind of a guy was he?
Well, there were so many things to say about this. One of the examples of his emotional life, I really believe, is that his notion of how to paint, how to show movement, was by attempting to show thought. Every one of his paintings that is left to us, and of course the small drawings that we have, makes this recognizable. He was trying to imagine what his subjects were thinking, and he was trying to show that emotion on their faces, which makes him a little different than Michelangelo, who was primarily interested in movement from the point of view of the way the muscles were working, whereas Leonardo was thinking about how the mind was working.
But I've also read that he personally, if you met him, that he would always make you smile. On the other hand, I've read that he was a bit of a misanthrope and referred to people as fillers of privies and that sort of thing.
Well, I like to think of him in that first category. Some of the people who lived during his time and left recollections of him wrote specifically about his sweet nature. It was Michelangelo who was the nasty fellow, and of course Michelangelo resented the older Leonardo. They got into several significant spats, and those who were nearby and who left those descriptions make it sound much more as if Michelangelo was the awful boy, and Leonardo was the kind, older, gentle fellow.
Let's go back to the phones. Peter joins us from Fort Lauderdale.
Yes, I was wondering if your guests had heard the theory that the Mona Lisa is actually a self-portrait. There is a self-portrait that he did later in life that if you take it, it's exactly one half the size of the Mona Lisa. You take it, you reverse it, you put it on top of the Mona Lisa, and the bone structure of the face identically matches that of the Mona Lisa. And Verrocchio had written that Leonardo was an extraordinarily beautiful young man, quite feminine looking. And I was wondering, since he took 16 years to paint that painting and was not generally known to be in the company of women for such a long time, that he perhaps used himself as a model. And it would be interesting to note that his self-portrait later in life was kind of like an answer to the riddle of the smile of this is what this is about. This is really a self-portrait.
Wasn't that an old song by Little Milton, Grits Ain't Groceries, and Mona Lisa Was a Man?
I don't know, but there was a woman in New Jersey who fed things into a computer, art information into a computer, and asked for it to spit out oddities, and it spit out the self-portrait of the Mona Lisa and that of the older Leonardo, and said this is the same person based on like forensic studies of bone structure.
Hmm. Well, of course, I'm absolutely convinced that you're right, not on the basis of what we know from computer diagrams or whatever, or even later descriptions. Here's Leonardo, a homosexual male. If we're to accept some of the Freudian notions about homosexuality, a certain proportion of homosexuals are homosexuals because of an identification with their mother. We know from much of Leonardo's anatomical work that he was fascinated by childbirth. He was fascinated by the female internal sexual organs, and he was fascinated by motherhood. And here we have this wonderful picture, the Virgin of the Rocks, this other wonderful picture, Saint Anne, Virgin and Child. In the backgrounds of those pictures, we see primordial Earth, our planet, as it must have been, as he saw it at the time of its birth. So here he comes along, and he does a portrait of a young woman, makes her look older than she really was, because she was only 24 when he started doing this. He did it in about half the time that you had mentioned. It was about 4 years. And it's been my thought that because motherhood fascinated him, he made her look much more motherly than she was in real life. And his identification with his own mother put him into the portrait. So what we're looking at here is biography and autobiography at the same time. And actually, I discussed this in significant length in this book of mine, Leonardo da Vinci, and I'm glad you asked the question.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call, Peter.
Thank you.
Much along the same lines, an email from Daniel Tideman, who's the art director at Tulsa Law Magazine. As an art student, I recall sitting in a darkened art history class listening to a lecture about Leonardo da Vinci, along with the standard discussion of his great works and inventions. My professor read a line from a book about da Vinci in which the author discusses Leonardo's 20-year love affair with a young man who was only 10 when the affair started. I just smiled and sat up in my chair. I hope I can still shock people 500 years after my death.
Well, of course, Leonardo was surrounded all of his life by attractive young people. There was one in particular who was with him for, perhaps 20 years. And it's one of the reasons that many of those who studied his life are absolutely convinced that he was homosexual. We have no evidence whatsoever that he actually functioned as a homosexual. In fact, you know, Freud's notion about Leonardo is that he completely repressed all sexuality. And all of his libidinal energy, as the psychoanalysts would put it, was sublimated into his work. And it's that thesis that may explain why he was able to accomplish such an unbelievably enormous amount of work throughout his life. He functioned as though he were completely asexual, which, again, the analysts tell us is repressed sexual energy.
Let's go now to Christina, who's on the line with us from San Antonio.
Hi. I'm really excited to be on the phone with this subject because I have affinity for Leonardo da Vinci. But my main question was, what are your thoughts about the authenticity of the Mona Lisa? Because I remember learning that it disappeared from the Louvre and it resurfaced in Italy, but it was cut from the frame, and they can't really tell if it's there's a lot of speculation about its authenticity.
So the one that's in the Louvre now might be a copy, is what you're saying?
Yes.
Okay.
And because there was no record of it photographically or anything, that they can't really compare from what it was.
Dr. Newland?
I'd love to hear an art historian respond to that. Of course, one hears that from time to time, but my thought, and I hope I'm not wrong about this, is that the great majority of art historians do believe that what we're looking at is authentic.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks for the call, Christina. An email we got, this from Eric Ness. I've been a lifelong student and admirer of Da Vinci. I will never forget the first time I saw his work exhibited in Seattle, the Hammer Codex, where I was moved to tears. Isn't the Hammer Codex also known as the Lester Codex?
I've never heard it called the Hammer Codex. It's the Lester Codex. That's what it's called.
Didn't Armin Hammer own it for some time? Is that possible?
Oh, that's very possible. He owned just about everything else in the world, didn't he?
I think so. What is that exactly?
I can't tell you precisely what's in it. It's a minor collection of his papers. You know, we have something like 5,000 pages, and it may very well be that there were twice that number or maybe three times that number. And except for something called a treatise on painting, which is created from many of his pages that were taken out of notebooks and put together long after his death, there is no organized study. There's something about Flight of Birds that's reasonably well organized, but he did not create books. He did not create full manuscripts. He just wrote his notes, made his pictures, and kept counsel with himself.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Dr. Newland, as we've talked about before, he was famous for dropping projects in midstream, not finishing things, and for working very slowly, admittedly not 13 years on the Mona Lisa, but 4 years is still a long time. Why do you think that was?
Well, I have a theory about that, and I'm not sure whether I'm correct or not. I thought, as I studied his life, is that the older he got, the more fascinated he became by anatomy. He was determined that he would find out the secret of what life is. He used to say, or write, that at some point I'm going to create a study of actually what health is, what the body is, what life is. And he would take these commissions, get the money for them, and then go off and do other things. And very often his patrons were so angry with him that they never asked for the money back. And as he got older, I have thought for a long time that his real reason for being was to get away and study his anatomy. So he would take one of these commissions and then leave it because there was something going on that he wanted to work on, whether it was a dissected leg or whether it was simply to think about the motion of the body. And it's true that his work gets better and better and better, always with this theme, as he puts it in his words, what man is, what life is, what health is. He became less and less of an artist and more of a scientist as he got older.
Let's hear from Edward, who's with us from Salem, Massachusetts.
Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. I have heard recently and read a little bit about the fact that quite a few artists, all of a sudden, around this time, quite a few artists had all of a sudden gotten very real. And I was wondering, there's a theory about the use of camera obscura, and I was wondering if you thought Leonardo had used such a tool.
Well, of course, we'll never know the answer to that. This is a relatively recent notion, as you know, and I haven't seen any evidence or anyone suggesting that he was one of the artists who did this.
All right, thank you.
Interesting question, Edward. I realize that we dropped the ball on the half of a question a caller came up with before. Did he, at the end of his life, regard himself as a failure?
Well, I'm sure he did. This is a man whose whole function was to learn everything, and he had left no completed book. There was so much he still wanted to learn. Many of us have said we would like to die feeling that we're failures because our work is incomplete. And this is how he thought about himself. Of course, all of these manuscripts were known to only a very few people and had not been seen, so that some of the extraordinary discoveries had to wait decades, centuries, in the case of one particular anatomical discovery, right up until the 1960s, before it was found again.
Hmm. And he has been described as the first truly modern mind. I guess if you're the first, you might be a little lonely.
Well, you know, I keep quoting Freud, and maybe that's not fair, but there's this wonderful line that is quoted over and over again. Freud said of him in his book
Support.
About Leonardo, he was like a man who awoke early in the darkness while the others were still asleep, and that's certainly true.
Sherwin Newland, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Dr. Sherwin Newland is a clinical professor of surgery at Yale's School of Medicine and the author of Leonardo da Vinci. His latest book is called Lost in America, A Journey with My Father, and he was with us from the studios at Yale University in New Haven, Connecticut. We've been talking about Leonardo da Vinci, the artist and the man. When we come back, we'll hear more about his science from a BBC documentary producer who built full-scale models of some of Leonardo's inventions and actually tried them out. Our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address, totn@npr.org. Back after the break, I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Today we're talking about the life and work of another genius, Leonardo da Vinci. Though he's world famous for his paintings, he considered himself a scientist. Joining us now is Michael Mosley, executive producer of an upcoming BBC documentary series on the life of Leonardo da Vinci called Leonardo da Vinci. It's scheduled to air this spring, and he's with us by phone from his home in London. And welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Hi, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon. Now, a lot of us look at Leonardo's sketches of fanciful devices like helicopters and say, how charming. You took another decision. You decided to see if you could actually build some of those things.
Yes, because I've been sort of in love with Leonardo for at least 20 years, and I've always wanted to know whether any of the things he designed or how many of the things he designed would actually have worked. Academics have argued about it, but we thought it would be interesting to actually have a go and test it out.
So which ones did you choose to build?
Well, we obviously interested in flight, first of all, because Leonardo was absolutely passionate about flight. He always wanted to be able to fly like a bird, and he had at least three different plans for flight. The first one, which is quite famous, is his ornithopter, you know, flapping wings.
Right.
And it was very obvious that no human would have the power to do that. I think even Leonardo recognized that towards the end of his life. Then it was the helicopter, which was also another insane one. It would never have flown. There would never have been the power to get it round. But he did do two others, which are very interesting. One is a hang glider, which was actually, he designs this thing, and he draws it, and nobody has any idea what it is until the hang glider is invented in the 1970s. And then somebody looks at it and goes, blimey, it's a hang glider. And then people thought about testing it, but there was nobody insane enough to actually fly it until now. His other one is a parachute. He designed a parachute primarily, actually, to jump off cliffs because he obviously had no plane that would take him up there. Those were the two we started with. Let's do flight and let's do the parachute and the hang glider.
And what happened when you tried him out?
Well, the parachute was great because essentially it's made of exactly the same canvas that Leonardo painted on, so it brings arts and science together. It's a big canvas number with bamboo, and it is made with a square which then has canvas on it. It's big. And what most of the modern experts told us was that you need to put a hole at the top to stabilize it. That's what you'd do with a modern parachute. But we decided we'd go with Leonardo's designs, and we jumped it from 10,000 feet from a helicopter.
And who did you find courageous enough to actually try it?
A guy called Adrian Nicholas, who for a living jumps off cliffs, mountains, anything. And he's been a Leonardo nut for ages, so he absolutely, so to speak, leapt at the chance.
Now, you went on to try some other of his devices, again, using materials that he would have been available and in his time.
Absolutely. So we did the hang glider and indeed used the world champion to fly that. And we also did, because he was a great one for working for warlords, mainly because they would pay him. As I'm sure you've already told your listeners, he fought for some of the greatest tyrants in history.
Indeed.
And so he designed lots of things which are wildly impractical, but we thought it would be rather neat to test out his tank. So we built it and got the British Army to test it. And what is interesting about it is in many of Leonardo's designs, if you actually do them literally the way that Leonardo suggests you do in his drawings, then they are, frankly, bonkers and dangerous. For example, his hang glider, he suggests you fly it in exactly the opposite way that you would. And with the tank, there are a couple of, in a way, obvious design flaws. Now, that leads you to think some very, very interesting things, one of which is either this guy is incredibly careless, he's not as big a genius as we think, or he's deliberately building design flaws into it. We think the latter, because they are the sort of flaws which are fantastically easy to sort out if you happen to know, you understand the principles of mechanics, engineering, you know, and things like that. So we think, and we have a number of people who endorse that view, that he's living in an era where there are no copyright laws, and he's deeply paranoid for understandable reasons, because lots of people are spying on him. And he's also a bit of a pacifist at heart. He hates war, and yet he's fighting for warlords. So put those all together, and you can sort of put together an argument that Leonardo deliberately builds design flaws into his things so that people will not be able to rip him off.
Let's talk with Ben now, who joins us from Jackson, Wyoming.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Hi.
I had a question. Do you think that Leonardo was frustrated with the fact that the level of mathematics could not keep up with his scientific thinking?
I think absolutely, yes, because he got passionate about mathematics, particularly in the sort of 1500s, when he largely abandons his painting to pursue mathematics. But he was more of a sort of, in a sense, a sort of practical engineer than he was a theoretical thinker. So that although he fell really in love with the mathematics of beauty, he was obsessed with trying to find out if there were rules for absolute beauty and whether he could apply them to his painting. But he looked for unity and for mathematics in nature. He's obsessed by nature. And he was convinced he would find universal rules and is deeply frustrated throughout his life that he fails to do so.
Interesting question, Ben. Thanks for calling.
Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Let's hear now from Alex, and Alex is in Naples, Florida.
Hello, Neil.
Hello.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just have a question on Da Vinci for you.
Okay.
First off, I would like to know how true is the fact that Leonardo created the foundation or the blueprint of what later was to become the bicycle.
Is that one of his inventions?
It's another of those great urban myths. What actually happens, because everyone's prepared to subscribe anything to Leonardo, okay? What happens is a monk, they find in about the 1930s, they find a document in a library, and it's got a drawing, blimey, it's of a bicycle. So everyone thinks, wow, isn't that incredible? But it turns out when you actually do some analysis on the ink, it's clearly been written in about 1910. Somebody has just been doodling, and they draw it in. So, no, there's absolutely no foundation for the idea he invented the bicycle.
Pity. Seems like a good idea.
It's part of the great mythology that surrounds Leonardo, and there are all sorts of examples of it. I think I was hearing earlier this notion that the Mona Lisa might be a self-portrait. Now, again, a lot of experts don't think that's true simply because the painting that is supposed to be that of Leonardo, Leonardo doesn't describe it as a self-portrait. He just says it's a portrait of an old man. It's only in the 19th century that somebody comes up with the notion that it's a self-portrait. Most people think it was just that was his style of painting faces at the time. So the fact that there is a relationship between the Mona Lisa and this painting is not surprising. Nobody knows what Leonardo looked like.
Alex, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
Here's an email we got from Scott Rice, and this may be somewhat along the same lines. It's been a while, he writes, but I remember reading something about Leonardo supposedly creating a massive weapon of defense. There seemed to be a matter of debate over whether the weapon was actually made or used. I was wondering if you could shed any light on that.
I think there's almost no evidence that any of Leonardo's great machines were ever built. All I can say is there is no evidence either way. He seems to have designed these things, but the various people, strangely enough, he's employed by warlords, but what they actually want him to do is to do things like make maps, paint portraits of their mistresses, and mainly to organize their parties. There's Leonardo who built robots. He was a great party giver, one of the greatest of his age. But strangely, having employed him because he's supposed to be this master engineer, that's not actually what they get him to do. So there's no great evidence that any of the wonderful machines he designed he actually built.
So we'll get to see these machines that he designed and you built in your documentary in the spring, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Well, thanks very much for being with us today, and good luck with finishing it.
Pleasure.
Michael Mosley, executive producer of a BBC documentary series on the life of Leonardo da Vinci called Leonardo da Vinci, scheduled to air this spring. And he was with us by phone from his home in London, England.